Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Mom.
You want to see if we can start this over again?
No, I really don't.
First take, I always feel like I do a terrible job, and then I want to start over and do it again.
Well, I think it's like a little bit nerve-wracking recording, too. I don't know.
It shouldn't be, because I can go in and edit stuff out, so yeah. I don't know what the deal is with starting
I'm always
over.
Worried
anyway.
That something's going to come out of my mouth that's like all terribly offensive, and like yeah. I won't know.
No, you'll know, and I always I go back over it, so don't worry about that part.
Not that I say horribly offensive things, but you know what I mean. It's like when a cop pulls you over and you, like, even though you don't have, like, drugs in your car, you're like, oh, shit, he's going to find drugs in my car.
I think that every time. Every single time a cop is behind me, I'm like, oh, my God, what if drugs are accidentally in my car?
Oh, my God, there's meth in my purse. Yeah, no, that's what I think.
Meth is in my trunk. All right, Chloe. So today we're talking about the story of Sherry Faye Smith and Deborah May Hellman. And what's sad about these two is if you look them up, if you Google them, they're always under Larry Jean Bell. That's the primary person who comes
up. A feral, disgusting man.
He's a disgusting person. Hate him.
And yeah, we just think that the victim should always be
highlighted
and you know, talked about, memorialized, all that good stuff.
Absolutely. And you know what? We'd like to introduce ourselves since we haven't done that yet.
Did we?
Welcome to True Crime Family Time with myself, Shannon.
And me, Chloe.
My daughter. This is how we like to spend our time together, talking about murder.
Murder. Are you going to put that at the beginning?
No, it's going to go just
it's
like
just
this.
It's going to go like just
yep,
this.
This is us. This is our ADHD selves, and that's okay.
Yes, I'm sorry. And we're just going to bounce around a little bit.
It's fine. So today, you know, I wanted to talk about this, as I was saying earlier, because when you were little and Tucker was in my tummy, I was pregnant, I went to hear this woman speak, Dawn Smith. I believe her last name is Jordan now. And she spoke about her sister's murder. She was murdered when she was 17, and they were very close, and it was a very moving talk. Mm-hmm. She talked about it, but she didn't go into like the details. It was more like I overcame this kind of thing, you know, how her family overcame this. And she was selling her book, Grace So Amazing. I bought it, went home and read it, and was absolutely horrified by what happened to this family. Like, at the time, I was not my true crime loving self. I was very hormonal, pregnant, had a young daughter. And I just,
I cried.
At the time, we were living near where this happened. So now, granted, it's 20 years later, but all I could think about was
like,
you know what?
Literally down the street.
Yeah. Like, this is terrifying to me. this is so scary.
I mean, it's just close to home and like.
Close to home. Yeah.
It happened
anyway. So my sources for this, first of all, the book, I read the whole book, When a Killer Calls, by profilers John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. And John Douglas actually was one of the FBI people who started the behavioral analysis unit. And he is who Netflix's Mindhunter is based on, which is super cool. They just knew this kind of psychological study of minds of criminals could be used to profile people in order to help law enforcement catch them.
Which is a show that I definitely need to watch.
Absolutely.
I guess I just never have.
I cannot believe you haven't watched it. It is scary, but it's really good. The next thing I watched on the case with Paula Zahn, 1 Month of Terror. It's a really good episode that had lots of interviews with the family and law enforcement. Mm-hmm. ForensicFilesNow.com, Southern Fried True Crime podcast.
That's
on
cute.
This case. I love, she does, like, you want to talk about in-depth research on cases?
Right.
Hers, epic. I love it. Also Wikipedia, also Murderpedia. Did you know that was a thing?
Murderpedia?
Yeah, Murderpedia.
Wow, I love murder.
Murderpedia. It's a happy little
website. Super happy, yeah. Oh my goodness.
So nice, right?
Murderpedia.
All right. That's scary. All right, so we're going to get started talking about Sherry Faye Smith. On May 31st, 1985, Sherry Faye Smith was running around her hometown of Lexington, South Carolina, getting ready for her senior trip and graduation. She was going on a cruise to the Bahamas, and she was set to sing the national anthem at at their graduation and had just finished up graduation practice that afternoon. Very talented singer, she and her sister.
Stunning.
She's gorgeous.
Both of them are so beautiful.
Gorgeous girls.
Gorgeous girls.
And very close sisters. So after meeting up with her mom at the bank to get traveler's checks for her trip, she goes to a graduation pool party with her boyfriend and her best friend, and then heads home to Platte Springs Road, where they lived, out on just lots of acreage, really long driveway, and just kind of out in the country. Mm-hmm. As was her habit, each day Sherry stopped at the mailbox at the end of their long driveway to get the mail. Her parents, Bob and Hilda Smith, were home, and Bob saw Sherry's car pull up to the mailbox, and after about 10 minutes, he realized she hadn't come back in the house. So he looks out the window, and he still sees her car by the mailbox.
No.
Mm-hmm. He quickly jumps in his car. That's how long the driveway is. He jumps in his car and rushes down to the mailbox. He was worried because Sherry has a rare form of diabetes called diabetes insipidus. This requires massive hydration as well as medication to control it. And just like if she's not constantly drinking water, she can literally die of dehydration.
Oh my God.
So he was worried maybe she'd been too busy, you know, and hadn't drank enough or whatever. So he gets down to the mailbox and finds Sherry's car still running. The driver's side door open, her purse and shoes are on the seat, medications in her purse, and mail is scattered on the ground. Bob knew in that instant that Sherry had been taken. Like,
oh my God.
There was nothing else in his
head.
She
wouldn't have left her stuff.
No, no, not her medication, nothing. Her shoes, she was without shoes.
Right.
Car was running. So he races back to the house, and he and Hilda call the police, like, right away. Luckily for them, and this does not happen often, usually it's like, oh, a teenager's gone, you have to wait 24 hours.
Yeah, but
or,
she's like,
yes,
18
exactly.
now?
Yeah.
Right? She's 17. About to graduate? Mm-hmm. I guess 17 is better than 18, right? And
yeah. But, you know, usually it's like the 24-hour wait. Oh, was she a runaway? Was she unhappy at home? Very lucky for them. Sheriff James Metz, who's the sheriff of Lexington County, is a friend of the family. And actually, he was sheriff when we were still there, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was sheriff for a long time.
Did I meet him ever?
I don't know. I don't know.
There's no reason for me to.
I don't think sheriff, you were like four. I don't think you met him.
If
we did, yeah.
I met him.
You did, honey. You did. He's a friend of the family, which is really good. Yeah. He knows that this is a serious situation right away. Mm-hmm. And due to his knowledge of the family, her illness, the scene that was left, Sheriff Metz organizes the largest search party to date in South Carolina. Like, they go in. They had so many volunteers, Chloe. Everybody knew this family.
Right.
Bob was an engineer, but he was also like a chaplain at the church. Mm-hmm. And so everybody knew this family and they loved them. They're very sweet people. Mm-hmm. They had the largest search party and the whole family has gathered at the Smith home, including her older sister, Dawn, who's come back from school, and her brother, Robert.
She was in college, her sister, right?
Yeah, Dawn was in college. I want to say for the summer, she was in Charlotte. She was singing and working at, what's the roller coaster? Carowinds. Mm-hmm. Okay, they had singers and dancers.
That's cute.
So she was a singer and a dancer there. And actually, Sherry had been set to do that as well. Mm-hmm. She had gotten the job and was like, had trained for it. But then they found out she had nodules on her throat.
Oh,
and
no.
So she had to be like, no singing for like all summer. And she was really bummed about it. So approximately 2 days later, the phone rings in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
It is a distorted male voice asking to speak to Hilda, the mother. He tells her to expect a letter in the mail the next day. And he also described the black and yellow bathing suit Sherry had on that day to make sure that they knew he wasn't messing around.
Gross.
So instead of waiting to the next day, they rush, like law enforcement, to the post office right then.
Uh-huh.
Get in, dig through the outgoing mail. They find the letter addressed to the family. It is clearly written in Sherry's handwriting and is titled Last Will and Testament.
Oh, my God.
And that's the letter I give you. It is heartbreaking. Okay, I'll just read a little bit of it because it's just overwhelmingly sad. At the very top, it says Last Will and Testament. It has the date of June 1st, 1985 at 3:10 a.m. At the very top, it says, I love y'all. along the side, it says, God is love. And it's, oh, this is just heartbreaking. And says, I love you, Mommy, Daddy, Robert, Dawn, and Richard, her boyfriend, and everyone else, and all the other friends and relatives. I'll be with my father now, so please, please don't worry. Just remember my witty personality and great special times we all shared together. Please don't worry and let this ruin your lives. Just keep living one day at a time for Jesus. Some good will come out of this. My thoughts will always be with you. Please have the casket closed. I love you all so damn much. Sorry, Dad. I had to cuss for once.
Oh, my God.
So sad. And it goes on from there. And you can find that online. At the end, she also had a little sweet message for her grandmother. P.S. Nana, I love you so much. Kind of always felt like your favorite. Oh, my gosh. And you were mine. Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's heartbreaking. I don't know any 17-year-old in that position where she was being held.
That she would say just to keep living
to keep living your life and to be positive and don't let this ruin your lives. I mean,
what a beautiful, absolutely
beautiful soul. And from all that everyone says, all the interviews, people who knew her, obviously her family, she was amazing. Mm-hmm. So just what an amazing person. The letter is sent away to Forensics Lab to try to get any evidence off of it possible. So it's heartbreaking. It's sickening. Outside of this phone call and the letter law enforcement has, they don't have anything to go on. South Carolina law enforcement reaches out to the FBI and brings on members of the BAU, including profiler John Douglas, one of the leading agents who developed the BAU. Mindhunter is based on him. After that first call, they immediately set up a recorder and a trace on the Smith's phone line. The distorted voiced man called so many more times, Chloe. He mainly would speak to Hilda, but would also talk with Sherry's sister, Dawn.
Well, he wanted to... Yeah. Did they know she was dead at this point?
No. He was giving them false hope. Mm. He would tell them Sherry would be home soon, that she was okay, that she was drinking plenty of water, that they were watching movies. And he'd call and say, and please have an ambulance at the ready for when I bring her to you. Okay? This person was one step ahead. They traced the calls a few different times to different payphones, but by the time they would get to the address, he was long gone.
What a sick, like, calculated...
asshole.
Ugh, yucky.
John Douglas believed that his multiple calls were A, to exert control over the family, and B, to buy time for any evidence to be destroyed, saying that they thought she was probably already gone.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too from that letter.
Yes. Yeah. And he was waiting on decomposition of the body so
she didn't have her medicine with her, so she would have died.
Yeah, yeah. On June 5th, 1985, the phone rings again, and this time the call is very different. Mm-hmm. He talks to Hilda and tells her that he and Sherry became one on June 1st, 4:58 a.m.
What the hell does that mean?
I know. And then gives directions to where they can find Sherry. And he says, we'll be waiting for you there. It was Highway 378 towards Prosperity, where we were living at that time.
Insane. Yeah.
Behind an empty building in the backyard, law enforcement finds the body of Sherry Faye Smith.
Well, and you think about all those old houses we used to drive by.
I know, so creepy.
Out in Prosperity. I mean, like, I vividly remember that.
Yeah.
And, like... that's probably one of those houses where she was found, so you know? That's so devastating. Mm-hmm. So her body was found there. Oh, my God.
According to ForensicFilesNow.com, investigators found traces of duct tape on her face, suggesting the killer suffocated her. They concluded that Sherry had died of either suffocation or dehydration from her condition, according to court papers available on Murderpedia. Accounts vary as to whether or not the autopsy proved she had been sexually assaulted, but the man responsible ultimately would be charged with rape.
I mean, yeah.
I don't like it.
Mm.
I don't like it, babe. It's gross. Devastated, the family now has to go pick up the pieces, find a way to go on with life.
How can you, though? After you find out that you're... It's one thing to lose your child at 17. Mm-mm. It's one thing to lose your child, period. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing to lose them to such a horrific, disgusting human being.
Taunted you through phone calls.
Taunted you, ripped her. Literally, she was right there mm-hmm. in her driveway. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, like, wow. I can't believe her family went on after this.
I know.
I don't know if I could. They're mm-hmm. very strong people.
On the night before Sherry's funeral, this disgusting human calls again. He talks to Dawn this time, and he tells her how Sherry died.
I don't think he's a human. He might be a real demon person.
Yeah, absolutely. Just black on the inside.
Oh my God. In detail?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
He said he gave her a choice, and she chose suffocation.
What?
Dawn is in absolute shock. It's disgusting. Why would she have to listen to that? It's just terrible.
Awful. The police should have been. I feel like the police should have been at this point, you know, monitoring these calls because that is insanely traumatic.
Well, and interestingly enough, John Douglas tells Sheriff Metz that the key to catching this guy is going to be Dawn. He thinks he's becoming obsessed with her and all communication is going to have to go through her now. Oh. If she agreed, and she did, she agreed.
Oh, did she?
And she says from the beginning, I wanted to do anything to help. I was scared, but I wanted to catch who ever abducted and murdered my sister.
Okay, sorry, John Douglas. I didn't mean to judge you so fast.
I do think that it's horrific that she had to hear that. I don't like that at all. I think it's horrifying. Unfortunately, however, for the next few weeks, there were no calls at all. Until 2 weeks after Sherry's abduction in Richland County, 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick, 9 years old, I'll say it again, is playing in her front yard with her little brother, Woody. A neighbor happens to be looking out the window when he sees a bearded man pick up Deborah and throw her in his car and drive away.
No.
Yes. Yep. Drive away.
No.
911 is called right away, but Deborah is not found. The neighbor is able to describe the car as well as provide enough detail for a composite sketch.
Thank God.
Yeah. However, 8 days pass.
Do you think you'd be?
She is not found.
Do you think you'd ever be able to give enough information for a composite sketch?
I don't know if this is an ADD thing. I know I talk about it a lot. I just really struggle with it. I have it real bad. I can't take medication for it because of different issues I've had in the past with medications. It's very addicting medication and I can't take it. So I struggle with it a lot. So I am very unobservant because I'm always in my head. So if I'm talking to somebody, I am looking at you, but like I'm also nowhere in the vicinity. Agreed. My head is bouncing around like crazy. So I don't know if I'd be able to give a sketch.
I was just thinking about that the other day when recently, 2 days ago in our town, there was a fugitive.
Oh my God. Yes. That was terrifying.
That raped and murdered
somebody.
I believe it was a young girl, which was terrible and tragic and awful and disgusting. But he came here. Yeah. Charleston.
And we were all terrified for like
Everybody
2 days.
Was like the cops literally came to my salon where I work and they were like, hey, just make sure you keep your doors locked. And we were like, what the hell? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So I was thinking about if I saw him out in public, I would never be able to tell the police what he looked like or anything like
Good
that.
Good for that neighbor.
Honestly.
Being so attentive.
For real. Like, to look out the window and be like, okay.
Hey, neighbors, be nosy. It's fine.
And don't have ADD.
I mean, I can't help it. I don't know what to do about that.
Just don't have it, okay?
Just don't have it. Okay, so the neighbor is able to do this, and that's great. However, 8 days go by, nothing. They have no trace of her anywhere. Then the phone rings at the Smith home. Dawn answers the phone, and it's Sherry's killer. And he says, have you heard about Deborah Mae Helmick?
No.
Then gives her directions to her body. I'm dead serious.
Is he
bonkers.
I don't understand.
Sicko.
Is he trying to, like, do everything he can to traumatize this family?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that like his goal here?
It is. It's just something that was driving him. He liked the control.
Oh my God.
He was able to have over this family. It's just, it's horrific. So at this point, law enforcement doesn't have too much to go on, but back at the lab, listen to this. So the...
Where was her body?
It doesn't say where, I'm sure it says somewhere, but it didn't say where they found her body, which is heartbreaking. I don't even think about it. So, but listen to this. The letter that had been written on the legal pad, the last will and testament, when it was at the lab, there were indentions on the letter, like someone from a different page had pressed. Mm. You see what I'm saying? Mm. So they used some kind of crazy chemical process to pull out those indentions.
Oh my God.
And they got a partial phone number. The phone number, eventually, they got the whole one, tied back to Ellis and Sharon Shepherd, an older couple who lived near the Smith family.
Okay.
So they bring Ellis in for questioning. Obviously, he's a man. This, you know, the phone number was tied back to him. Mm-hmm. But during the two abductions and murders, the Shepherd's family had been traveling. So then they had Ellis listen to the recorded phone calls that they had of this person.
Right.
And there was one call where the voice had not been distorted. Like he was using something to distort his voice. Mm. One call, it wasn't. Ellis knew right away who the voice was. Larry Jean Bell. Bell had done some electrical work and had been house sitting during this time for them. So he was at their home house sitting. He even picked them up at the airport when they came home, and Ellis recalled that Bell would not stop talking about Sherry Smith's abduction and murder.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine finding that out?
How terrifying that a murderer, not even a regular murderer, like a sicko who kidnapped children and murdered them, was staying in your home. And guess what? Not just that. Using your notepad, but guess what else?
What?
Evidence was found at his house. So he had them there.
He had them in her... Oh, yeah. My God. I know.
So Larry Jean Bell is brought in, actually, without incident. In the interrogation room, the detectives had laid out items belonging to Sherry and Deborah, hoping to evoke some kind of emotion, some kind of confession. Mm-hmm. He was silent. And instead... He insists on speaking in person to Hilda and Don Smith, and they agree to it.
No.
Anything to try to help.
I guess so. I mean, those are very strong
words. I would have scratched his gosh darn eyes out.
I know you would have.
I don't know how she held it together.
She knew that that's what she had to do to find her daughter's killer, and I think that she just did it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
They're hoping to get him talking, but Bell refused to say he did it. It is heartbreaking, and the recording of that is also online. The recording of Don and Hilda talking to him. They're like, we just want to know what happened. Mm-hmm. And the mom says, I believe I am looking at my daughter's killer. I wish you would just tell us what he'd like. I would if I could.
Oh my God.
As it turns out, they didn't even need a confession. When they executed the search warrant at the Shepherd home, they found blood and hairs that matched Sherry's, as well as the actual notepad her last will and testament was written on. During the trial, Larry Jean Bell tried his best to seem actually insane. He would yell out random things during the proceedings. He took the stand on his own behalf. In the middle of that, he asked Don to marry him.
And he wasn't actually insane?
No, he's not insane. I forget who they were interviewing, and he said, I just had to impress upon the jury, he's not a mad dog, he's just a bad dog. You
gotta
see past all the crazy he's trying to do. It did not work.
He's trying to portray himself as
crazy to get the insanity plea.
Yeah, okay.
Nope, didn't work. The jury deliberated for 1 hour and brought back a guilty verdict.
Hell yeah.
He was also tried and found guilty for the abduction and murder of Deborah May, which is, God, that's heartbreaking. Because the thing is, she doesn't get talked about like a whole lot. In the information and looking at it, it's just more about Sherry, I guess, because he called that family so much and was really just intent on hurting them. And so that's what it's, you know, all about. But that sweet girl, it just, it's heartbreaking. Yeah. I hate it so much. They did interview her mother in the show I watched. And she, God, it just, she just looks broken. I would be broken.
There's no way to fix that.
So the sentence for both was the death penalty.
Slay.
Yeah, listen. I don't always know where I stand on the death penalty. I just don't know. But this is one time when I'm like, absolutely yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just glad he was found guilty. Mm-hmm. I really don't know where I stand either.
I go back and forth, but this kind of stuff with children, this kind of horrific mind games he was playing with the Smith family, gross.
When I say slay,
yeah,
I mean,
she means legit.
I'm like, slay that's him. Awesome. I'm so glad he was found guilty. I think that I wish that he would have just rotted in jail and been like brutally assaulted by everybody that went to jail with him. That's my thing. Yeah. I don't, either way. Yeah, really. It's, mm-hmm. I'm just glad he's gone. But yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, the death penalty is something like super controversial and weird, you know?
Well, Larry Jean Bell was electrocuted on October 4th, 1996, at the age of 46. He had no final words. Mm-hmm. Bell was the last death row inmate in South Carolina executed by electrocution until James Neal Tucker was executed in 2004 for the double murders of Rosalie Dolly Oakley and Shannon Lynn Mellon. That's something I think we're going to have to look into, those two, because I haven't really looked into those before. Although once I start looking to them, I'm like, oh yeah, I know
what that is. We know a lot of them. Yeah. Well, we just, I mean, that's what we did, especially during COVID. Like every day was a new true crime case.
Yeah,
which is probably why our mental health was so bad.
We had, you remember when our podcast was called Crime and Anxiety? It still stands true. I just like the catchy.
But I think we're a little less anxious now. I don't know. COVID was. I'm not. Oh,
I'm always anxious. Sorry.
I'm pretty much always anxious too, but you know.
So funny. Can I tell you a story of the book was called When a Killer Calls, and so it reminded me of the scary phone call I got. I probably told you this before.
Oh my God, this is a great story.
I hate it. It's so scary. When I was about 13 years old, I was home by myself. My parents were at church, I think, and I was sick, so I was home, and the phone rings. This man, it's like, hey, this is AT&T, and your parents are supposed to be getting this really big refund, but I need to verify some information first so they can get their check in the mail. And I was like, great, okay. Y'all, when I say the word naive, stupid, dumb little girl, that was me.
You were just a child.
I don't care. You at 13 years old would have known better. Would you not have? No, I wouldn't have. Yes, you would have, because I have talked to you about these things. Don't tell me that, Chloe. I thought I've done a good job.
You don't know the shit I did when I was 13.
And I don't want to know. Girl. That's not for this podcast.
It's for another one.
A
trauma dump pod.
Oh, jeez. I can't handle it. So, anyway, I told him everything. He would say, what's your address? I'd tell him. He goes, yep, that's what I have here. What's your, well, I don't know, other phone number? Where do you go to school? Where's your brother go to school? How old's your brother? How old are you? Why would I give him this information? Why?
No, I wouldn't have done that.
Okay. I hope not.
I wouldn't have done that.
I gave him everything. Why would this information have been pertinent to any kind of refund? I don't
know. How old were you?
13.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a little dumb.
It's a little dumb.
So I gave him all the information, and then he goes, well, Shannon, thank you so much for being very honest with me. I appreciate it, but I'm not from AT&T. I'm actually a prisoner at the whatever jails near us. He said, I'm actually a prisoner. You can look at the paper tomorrow and see all the people I've murdered.
Insane.
And I know where you live now, so I'll be coming to get you.
So
he said he was coming to murder me and my family because now he knew where we lived.
What a terrifying reality.
When I still remember the feeling to this day of my whole body just going cold. I ran out of the house so fast.
Oh, I bet.
At the time, we had a detective living kind of across the street a little bit. I ran over to their house in my nightgown, banged on the door, bawling my eyes out, told him the whole story, and then also said, I forgot my dog. And I went back, and I was scared to death, and he took me back to get my dog, and I waited there till my parents came home.
Oh, my God.
So as it turns out, it was this rash of phone calls being made from the actual prison because the prisoners were bored. They had gotten used to the phone somehow.
And he wanted to scare a little girl?
He called all kinds of people. He evidently called all kinds of people, just whoever would answer their phone.
And he would just be like, thank you, I'm actually going to murder you.
Yeah.
Was he actually a murderer?
I don't know. I never found out that part. But
what a banana story.
I was terrified and at 13 years old slept in my parents' room probably for the next 2 weeks.
Well, let's be honest.
At least.
You slept in my room until I was like 15.
Chloe was constantly scared to death.
I was an anxious child. Okay.
We had twin beds in the room for that purpose. I slept in there a lot.
I would think I was dying. So
she did think that. It was sad.
Hope you're happy about that.
I'm not happy about that. But I do want to very quickly, I don't know if you've been keeping up with Vanderpump at all.
No.
Oh my God, Chloe. That was your homework, was to watch the episode.
I can't do that for you.
Okay. So I watched the reunion part one, and Sandoval comes out swinging with his excuses, trying to lay all of their problems at Ariana's feet. We were having problems. Okay. We hadn't been intimate in a long time. Just all this crap.
Excuses.
It doesn't matter. She had a great comeback. She's like, none of that gives you the excuse
literally
to cheat, especially with my best friend.
Insane.
So not just one time, for months and months and months. Okay.
If I was him, I would. Why are you trying to excuse yourself?
Everybody hates you.
Everybody literally hates
you. You need to be
guts.
groveling.
Literally, just groveling.
But the way he comes off is like, I'm sorry, but this is what was going on. So
I'm
this
sorry,
is why.
But
I'm sorry, but. I'm sorry you feel this way.
Yeah, I hate, yeah. And I'm sorry, but.
No, she kept it cool. She's doing a great job. She's really winning in life right now.
She's a slay.
She is a slay. Chloe says that word all the time. Don't really know what it means.
It's a hair thing.
All right, Chloe, where can they find you on Instagram?
You can follow me at Chloe Diana. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I don't have any other things I want to give you.
Yeah.
You
know? Instagram for us is True Crime Family Pod. And then you could email us at our old timey email. If anybody does email anymore, Shannon in Reality, because I haven't changed it. So shannoninreality@gmail.com. And we will be back next week with a new story. Hope you enjoyed today's. Till next time, y'all stay safe.
Please.